what I was told by Eddie Cummings, who I trained with since I was a blue belt, one of my teachers, is you have to develop a guard that's really hard to pass. You shouldn't never be willing to let anybody pass your guard. That's the first layer of jiu-jitsu, is you need to have a guard that's impassable. So, like, I feel like a lot of people leave guard retention out of curriculum because it is so hard to teach.
Welcome to Forever White Belt. I'm your host, Adolfo Ferranda, and I couldn't be more thrilled about the episode we have in store for you today. This interview has been on my bucket list, and I'm very honored to bring you this conversation. In this episode, we dive deep into the world of jiu-jitsu with none other than John Callestine, a black belt under the esteemed Daisuke Yamaji of Henzo Gracie Fight Academy. Forgive me if I butchered his name. But John's journey doesn't stop there. He's trained extensively with luminaries such as Eddie Cummings, John Danaher, Gordon Ryan, the rest of the Danaher Death Squad, and more, shaping him into the formidable grappler and coach he is today. John is renowned as one of the premier 145-pound grapplers of his generation, having made waves in the submission-only professional grappling circuit with victories at events such as Eddie Bravo Invitational, Ana Invitational, Zapatero Invitational, and Finisher Sub-Only, and more, of course. In this episode, John shares invaluable insights into the evolving landscape of leg locks in jiu-jitsu, drawing from his vast experience and expertise. Moreover, he offers a rare glimpse into the early days of his training, rubbing shoulders with the previously mentioned legends Eddie Cummings and John Danaher. Whether you're a seasoned practitioner or just starting your jiu-jitsu journey, John's wealth of knowledge and effective teaching style makes his content a must-watch. Join us as we unravel the intricacies of the sport with one of its most respected figures. And with that, I give you John Callestine. John, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is such a tremendous honor for me. You know, I was basically stalking you for quite some time trying to get you on the show. So please forgive my persistence.
No, I appreciate it. I actually really appreciate it that you kept wanting to have me on the show. I'm sorry. I've just been very much running around all over the place. But happy that I finally got to make it happen.
No. I am a huge fan, and there's a reason why. I typically don't go like that hard in the paint to get someone on the show. But, man, I've been watching your career for years and years and years, and your development. Amazing to see your improvement, how you developed as an individual from being, you know, fierce competitor, being this competitor instructor now, the different academies and people you've trained with. Man, what a life you've led.
No, thank you. It's been fun. I mean, definitely over the years from just like competing in like little tournaments and gyms and traveling to places like Texas and Florida and competing in money grab tournaments where I would just put up, you know, $150, fly out there to win some money to get my name out there and local grapplers quest, Navas and then BBIs and then competing Kasais. And now a lot of my focus has been teaching. But still, there's still some competitive focus, competitive drive there, but definitely still really enjoying teaching and that aspect of my life now. So it's crazy how things have changed a lot in the 8 years from when I first started competing to when I first started training 12 years ago, I think it was. So a lot of different stuff, a lot of different phases of my life so far.
You just have such a wealth of experience, and the people that you've trained under and trained with is just, I mean, it's really the who's who of jiu-jitsu. And so you have so much to offer these students. And not only that, but just how you've evolved as an instructor passively, as I see you on IG or YouTube or whatever it may be. You have so much information, such great information. You articulate it and you show it so well. Can you talk about how you've developed that?
Honestly, it's just been, I think, years of being in the room with a lot of good instructors. And then, yeah, I'm still learning. It's definitely one of those things that, like, in the future, I would like to be able to have, like, a solid jiu-jitsu team full of competitors and stuff like that. That's, like, another future goal of mine. But I have a couple of people now that, like, compete consistently. And I have, like, a solid base of students that, like, you know, they like competing for fun and they take it fairly serious. But I think it's just years of being around good instructors, getting to spend time around John Donner or Eddie Cummings, and then even like training a lot with Gordon and those guys years ago. But definitely a lot of like organization and how I like work at putting together stuff to be able to teach, I picked up from John, and then a lot of stuff in terms of like figuring out new ideas and things that I want to work on were always like things that I picked up from Eddie. And those were like the two people that I spent a lot of time around. And then, you know, also like I got to like experience taking like a class with me from like Sean Williams. He was also like, I think, really, really, really good instructor. And then I just watched a lot of the time. I do spend some time like just as much as I've spent in the past watching and still do like jiu-jitsu matches and studying other people's techniques, I watch what other people do to help people learn jiu-jitsu too. You know, so I've been watching a lot of that because I do want to make sure that all the people that train with me are improving. I like to see that improvement almost just as much as I see my own improvement. Just watching how people teach, and there's also a lot more information now on people teaching. You see people putting stuff out there of like their structure and how they teach, and just like people say, the easiest way to get good at jiu-jitsu is take a little bit here and there, steal a couple ideas from here, a couple ideas from there. That's kind of like what I've been trying to do. So it's just trying different things, you know, seeing what works, what doesn't. Maybe doing certain things has been helping, and certain things I have noticed haven't helped. You know, it's just experimenting with different ideas, different techniques, teaching, not just actual movements or things of that nature.
And so you're now at King's in a beautiful area, Williamsburg, Brooklyn, New York, right?
Yeah, I'm at King's, and I also teach at Henzo, Brooklyn, too. So I'm at both gyms, yeah.
Now, way back, you trained gi some too, right?
Years ago. It wasn't day one, no gi. Actually, day one was gi in the white belt class at Henry's in the city. That was day one. Just in that moment, I got kind of hooked on it. I competed my first time ever. I think it was like 2 months into training because I got into jiu-jitsu with the mindset of competition. I watched MMA. I watched pro wrestling. Like, it was like, I want to do this to pursue it, whether it was MMA or jiu-jitsu, whatever it was, I wanted to pursue something in combat sports. Of course, at the time, jiu-jitsu wasn't like considered like something that you can do as a career. So of course it was like, oh, maybe I want to play MMA. And that was my mindset as a 17-year-old kid watching the UFC. It's like, that's what I wanted to do. So I was like, all right, this is one part of it. You go do jiu-jitsu. And that's like a part of MMA. So like my main goal was always in training was to compete. So I jumped into competition right away. So my first 2 months was in the gi. And then I still trained in the gi until I got my blue belt. And then once I got my blue belt, I stopped training in the gi completely. And now I'll put it on like once a year at most. The other day, I just put the top on the other day, just messed around with one of my students, but that was about it.
We got to get a video of that sometime. You got to post that stuff, man.
There's a couple of videos of you rolling in the gi. Honestly, one thing I'll say is that I do enjoy rolling in the gi sometimes, just because I feel whenever I train in the gi, I don't put a pressure on myself to actually be good at it. So I find myself like having fun and like just playing with random stuff because there's nothing that I'm like, yeah, this is what I'm focusing. Like, no gi. Like, whenever I train a training session, I have, like, goals in mind. I have things that I want to get better at. And I find myself putting pressure on myself. Like, I have to get better at this technique. So it has to be, like, super focused. And, you know, I find myself just putting a lot of stress on myself with certain things. And when things aren't working, you know, figuring out. When I go put the gi on, I feel like a hobbyist more. You know, it's like I'm just kind of, like, having fun. I'm, like, wrapping the lapel around my leg and stuff, having no idea what the heck I'm doing anyways. And just like fall across stuff because I just kind of, I watch jiu-jitsu as a whole. So I watch gi and no gi matches. So I know a lot of the fundamentals of the gi. You asked me to get into like the super complicated lapel guards and stuff. I don't know any of that really, but I know I can mess around with it. I have an idea of like, all right, if I wrap my leg around the lapel here and WUBA and all these things, like I kind of have an idea that's going on. But every time I do it, I realize it's kind of fun now. And before I felt like it was a chore because it was like mandatory. I had to put it on, you know, where now it's like I put it on every once in a while for fun and I do kind of enjoy it. So it's something I could see myself in the future doing maybe a little bit more here and there.
So your thoughts on like seeing guys like Marigali and Tynan going gi to no gi and their outcomes?
I think with the MMA jiu-jitsu, I think it's definitely learning certain aspects make a difference. Like with no gi, the leg rocks is a much bigger thing, right? So you took a guy who only trains in the gi and he has no idea how to defend an inverted heel hook or even do a heel hook. You know, I say they're putting themselves at a big disadvantage and they're probably going to get caught by somebody who might not be nearly as good as them just because of the fact that they have no idea what's going on. But I think you take somebody that's that good at jiu-jitsu, even in the gi, and then you teach them just some of the simple ideas of how to not get leg locked, like just the right way to turn. Just learning the right way to defend the position makes somebody so much better that now you take those guys and you just teach them the right way to react to those common leg positions. And now those guys were so good at jiu-jitsu already, now it's all good luck. Yeah, they're going to be so much harder to deal with. So they're not going to go out there probably and like heel hook anybody that's all they do is leg locks. But now they have a good idea how to stay safe if they do end up in those positions. They know what to do in terms of their own gain at a certain point to like, all right, well, this I'll do this in the gi usually, and I don't have to worry about if I end up in a leg position because they can't go for the yoke or they can't reap the knee. But in no gi, it's like maybe I don't do this specific movement because of the fact that there is a yoke involved, there is a leg position involved, there is a knee reap involved, you know, so... Once they recognize those positions, those guys, they're already so good at jiu-jitsu that it's probably easier for them. You know, where like years ago, it was like the leg locks were very big because less skilled people at jiu-jitsu as a whole can go in and beat a world champion black belt with a leg lock because they've never experienced any real leg entanglements before. Now I think it's a little different. You see the leg game. You still see some people like that, you know, at the highest level, they still don't really know any leg locks. But then you see guys like just learn the basics, and then you see guys that like their whole game is leg rocks, where it's like, well, now the game evolves. So that's why you see the leg game evolving so much, where you're seeing more than just a basic inverted yoke from cross off your saddle. People don't get that anymore. There's a lot more involved to it. You don't see people just getting a reaping outside the yoke anymore. There's a lot more involved with it. Occasionally, you'll see it at the heavier weight classes, but you don't really see it at the lighter weight classes anymore. You know, people just are more aware. So, and that's where you see people doing things like very evolved entries into the legs, like full sweeps and evolved leg positions, like the hip lock position. Like, you see all these evolvements because, like, yeah, the hip lock comes from a knee read, and it's like, well, we can't finish your work on anybody really did from a knee leap because they understand the right way to turn. Well, there's this other option where you're maintaining leg position of break legs, and it's probably stronger than going through your pinky hook. So it's like the game just evolved as people start to learn the sport, and as a whole, just evolves. You know, the techniques just evolve.
It also helps that those guys have the AOJ brothers and Danaher as coaches now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's a big thing now, coaching a lot bigger than it was years ago. I remember, I think, there were many places where people trained that were considered professionals that had, like, from what I saw, like, full-time coaches. It was one guy that was, like, a high-level competitor that had a team of guys that trained with him and everybody competed, and like, but there was just a one top dog kind of. Well, now it's like you have guys that's all they do is coach and building teams of other guys that want to be solely just competitors. That's where the sport's also evolving in the sense of, like, MMA, you see like gyms where it's like there's a head coach and then there's guys that just compete, you know, and that's the main focus of the gym. So you're definitely going to see more of that, especially as the sport starts to make money. There's no opportunities for people to be full-time coaches.
And there is a lot more money now, right?
I mean, yeah.
From back with, like you were saying, what you were doing, where you're paying $100 to really risk it.
Yeah. So we used to,
and for what?
Yeah. I mean, the big thing was that, you know, show up to a tournament like a Kumite, Jiu-Jitsu Kumite, or a Zapatero, and you put money up, and then you're basically betting on yourself to win $2,000. And I used to do those a lot, you know, and sometimes you don't win. Like, there's a pair that I did win, and my job was Jiu-Jitsu. Like, I did, like, a part-time job on the weekends, but, like, that $2,000 was going to pay for my flight, my stay. Of course, I'd always make sure that I get the cheapest possible travel expenses, you know, and then hoping to have at least $1,000 or so dollars left over to hold me off for the next tournament. So, like, that was kind of like how it was years ago, and now it's not the same. Now I think a lot of these tournaments, they don't even require you to pay an entry anymore to do these to win the money. So the sport's definitely, because of there being more eyes on it, there's definitely more opportunities for people to compete. There's more opportunities for people to make money. There's people now actually making a living just teaching full-time, where, like, people, I remember a lot of my jiu-jitsu instructors, like, some of them taught for a time, but for the most part, they made money teaching, but they still had, like, full-time jobs. But there was the rarity of, like, a John who, like, that's all he did was teach. You know, there's only a few people that were doing that when I first started training, from what I saw.
Now, you talk about lack of knowledge, you know, you're saying you still see some professionals, very few now, that may not know a certain aspect of the game or some, let's say, legs or whatever. You also still see it on the lower level, at the amateur level, right? The opens and things like that, probably even with your students when they go compete or something like that.
Yeah.
Some academies are still avoiding certain things. We could use legs as an example, some, as crazy as it sounds. Are you seeing that still pervasively? I mean, I still see it.
I definitely know it's out there, and I know when I travel to other, like, parts of the country, definitely I see it a little bit more. You don't see it as much in the New York area or, like, the major hubs of jiu-jitsu. You definitely don't see it as much. Well, you definitely see it when you go to like smaller areas with a little bit of smaller jiu-jitsu communities. I think there's still an aspect of like whoever the instructor is sometimes still doesn't want to adopt any new thing, because I think it's also that aspect of worried about having people leave their gym if they like admit that there's this other thing that you should be learning. And if there's another gym in the area that's teaching that, you don't want to admit like that's the stuff that we need to know. So you're like, oh, you don't need to know that. Definitely something that I think you see a lot less now because of the fact of how much the sport has grown, because of the fact that there's a lot more information out. I remember there wasn't as many instructionals until COVID. You know, when COVID hit, I feel like that's when the boom of instructionals started. And up until that point, people wanted information from a certain person. You looked out for a seminar and you went to one of their seminars and you were hoping that they would show whatever it was that you had in mind that they do that you wanted to learn from them. Or you were hoping that maybe they put out an instructional, but there wasn't like, Jiu-Jitsu with Fanatics was around a little bit before COVID, but I still like they didn't really put out that much information. And now it's just like there's instructional all over the place and you could get so much
John underscore Calistine.
Yeah.
Instagram, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. So I got some stuff on Jiu-Jitsu, Jiu-Jitsu X, my Patreon. Yeah, my Patreon. Like I have a bunch of, yeah, we'll get there. You know, I feel like there's so much information out there now, which I think it's also good because it's like, because I don't really have that much information. You know, when I first started, until I met like a core group of guys to train with, you kind of like figure it out. Like there were people that I trained with early on, instructors that I trained with early on, but it was like, it was just different. It was like teaching to a room. It was like I had to come across the right people to put me in the right direction. But at first it was like those first couple, that first like, I would say 6 months per year of training was just like looking on the internet for whatever you could find. You wanted to find any kind of instructional information, you were searching on YouTube to find anything. And there wasn't much on YouTube, or you bought a Budo videos instructional.
Right. DVDs or something.
Yeah. There were some DVDs out there, but also who didn't really have the money as an 17, 18 year old kid to go buy the instructionals. So you just search on the internet, whatever you could find on YouTube. And it was good because I learned how to watch jiu-jitsu matches and study matches early as opposed to just watching instructional. So I definitely think that's something that's important that I think not everybody does still. I think a lot of the newer generation, they only watch instructionals and they only watch matches of the person from the instructional. But I do think that you should be watching everything and everyone, even if you have footage of a local tournament, just watching what people are doing. You know, anybody could have an idea that, you know, people can be coming up with new ideas every day. You know, I think people forget about just watching everything, whether it's instructionals, matches, just everything, training footage. You should be watching everything. So definitely think there's more information out there now than there was even 3-4 years ago. You know, and I think that makes a big difference.
And you've always been, it seems like, a student of the game. You've always been, like, researching and watching and trying to get more information.
Yeah, like, I've always been, like, very much watching and studying. I've never been, like, the super organized studier. Like, I know there's people that, like, make, like, boards and write notes. Like, I've never been, like, super, like a big intellectual guy. Like, I don't claim to be that way. I'm very much, like, if I have an interest in something, I just watch it until it burns out, you know, and then it's like I take a break. That's kind of how I am with like jiu-jitsu stuff, like, and it's how I am with everything. I just watch with everything until like I kind of like need a break from it. Jiu-jitsu just so happens to be that thing because of the fact that it's always evolving. I never like had to take a break from it. I was always able to stay like kind of focused on it. But that's just always how my brain always worked, is just like I get like some idea of something in my head that I want information on. And then I just sit there, like, watching and getting whatever information I can on that topic. One of the topics that, like, ever since I was a kid, I always just watch tons of stuff on is the pain. You know, and it's just, like, I get into these spurts of just, like, watching every single video that I could find or every single article that I could find. And it's just how I am with jiu-jitsu. It's just I'll never lose that, that interest because of the fact that the sport is always evolving. I feel like every time you see a major tournament, you're just seeing the sport evolving. You're seeing different ways that people are approaching different things. You're seeing new ideas. You're seeing people that always played their game a certain way because the sport's evolving. You're seeing how they're evolving at the same time. So I definitely think, like, because of the fact of how fast the sport evolves, it's just helped me, like, you know, the way my brain works keeps me focused, even though I've never been like a big note taker or anything like that. Like, I just, like, you know, just always just watching, always just doing it.
Just a reminder to please give us a 5-star review on Apple Music and Spotify and become a VIP member for only 99 cents a month. Get ad-free episodes at anchor.fm/foreverwhitebelt/subscribe and check us out on Instagram at Forever White Belt Show. Go buy your Forever White Belt swag at Teespring, teespring.com/forever-white-belt. Check us out on YouTube now at Forever White Belt. Finally, if you ever get to beautiful Northern California, please come roll with us at North Bay Jiu-Jitsu in Marin County, just north of San Francisco. They're amazing instructors and everyone there are great people. Mention the podcast and get 2 weeks free. What's your curriculum like? Or are you just playing it by ear? Are you one of these field instructors? You know, I was just talking to Michael Lira Jr. and he's like, it's kind of like what I'm feeling at the moment. He's like, it's real difficult to teach to these people because they're all over the place. Someone's coming in, you know, who hasn't been in a while. And then, you know, there's an old guy, there's a young person, there's, you know what I mean? They're all over the place. So how are you dealing with this and trying to get all of this information in them?
There's a couple of things that I always try to stick to now. Like I said, I'm trying to learn how to be a better teacher. I'm trying to learn how to be a better instructor because I have people that are coming to me now and like they want to learn jiu-jitsu and they want to compete. And even if they don't want to take it to a point of like being a professional, they want to be the best they can at it, right? They're investing their time in it. So I should be investing my time in them too, right? So one of the things that I've realized is that it could be hard, especially because people are always in and out. And some people, like this week, they're training 2 days out of the week, and next week they're doing four, and then maybe the week after that they're doing once. So some of the things that I've realized is focusing on like certain skills for long periods of time, as well as focusing on certain techniques. So like a skill like that I was told that I should always focus on from day one was guard retention. I was told if you want to really, in the beginning, be good at jiu-jitsu. I know people always talk about being able to be hard to clip down and being good at kin escapes and all that. All that stuff is good too. But what I was told by Eddie Cummings, who I trained with since I was a blue belt, one of my teachers, is you have to develop a guard that's really hard to pass. You should never be willing to let anybody pass your guard. That's the first layer of jiu-jitsu, is you need to have a guard that's impassable. So, like, I feel like a lot of people leave guard retention out of curriculum because it is so hard to teach. So like, and I'm still trying to figure out, like, what's the best way to teach it. And what I realized is, like, honestly, one of the best ways to teach guard retention is showing basic movements, some basic concepts, and then having people do it every single day. So there was like months on end that I just had people work guard retention from flat on their back without any connection. And the job of the bottom person was just practice not getting your guard passed without making like a connection, like a deli eva guard, or without trying to pull somebody into close guard, without sitting up, you know, without trying to create distance. Like just practice being in a position where you're just concentrating on framing and pummeling your feet. And what I noticed is that made a big difference, and just doing it every day. Because I figure like most people for the most part is like, you got 2 minutes, right? Most people can push the pace pretty hard for 2 minutes. So I usually want the top person, like first round will usually be fairly light, let's say. And then after that, I want the pace to be picked up, right? Now, the job of the top person is to only be allowed to pass to the outside. So you're making it more difficult for the bottom person by only pass to the outside. That's how everybody's passing the guard nowadays. You're only allowed to pass to the outside. Anytime there's a pass, you reset. And for the bottom person, your job is if you can last 2 minutes without somebody passing your guard, putting that pace on you, you're already improving your guard. These are like little things that I've started to like try to figure out, is how can I have like these live drills where people can get live reps of working a specific skill. It's similar to like the positional training. I think like that you see a lot of people doing, like the standard jiu-jitsu guys, they do like very specific like positional training, and then they put certain restraints on the positions and stuff. I feel like that's important. And I feel like just doing like things like working a specific skill like guard retention, because at least if somebody has a good guard that's hard to pass, they're much more difficult to deal with for even a very good black belt. Because I noticed there's people who I can roll with who, yeah, maybe I might be better than a jiu-jitsu, but if they have like a good guard, it's going to take a little bit for me to get anything going if they understand the concepts behind guard retention. And the concepts behind guard retention, I think, help me in other areas too. Understanding inside position, understanding not exposing your limbs. These are all concepts that work whether you're playing guard, you're playing top, or any position you're doing. Even when escaping from bottom, you're not going to escape by pushing off and extending an arm, right? So I think just understanding guard retention helps you understand jiu-jitsu as a whole for the most part. And then just finding other drills that people are just working skills. So even if you're not there every day you are there, you're still doing skill development. So maybe you're not always picking up the techniques because you're not able to get the reps of it. But those couple skills that were working every day for that month, by the end of the month, you'll at least be better at those skills. Even if you aren't able to implement the techniques you went over for the month, you're getting better at that skill that we work on. And then the techniques, I kind of stick with the same theme for a month. And I'll do the same sequence of movements for an entire week. So if you only show up Monday, you got the same thing that everybody's getting on Friday. So nobody misses out. So it's the same thing. Maybe I'll add a couple details, but for the most part, I'm teaching the same thing for a week straight, and we're doing the same topic for a month, maybe sometimes longer than a month, depending on what the topic is.
The meta in jiu-jitsu right now is this thing called the ecological approach. Have you heard of this?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you were doing this before it was even called the ecological approach to people in jiu-jitsu, but...
Definitely not to that extent. But recently, like, we've always done, like, positional training. Like, I remember when I started not going to the cities when we started doing more positional rounds, like starting in mount, starting in internal, you know, like starting in closed guard as a full round. Like, I think that's when we first started doing that stuff. And I think that was probably like 2017, 2018 when I stopped training in the city a lot. So a lot of that also comes from the EBI rules. EBI rules, some only, it's like if you watch jiu-jitsu from the past, guys get their guard passed in an IBJJF match years ago. That means the match is over for the most part. The guy who got their guard passed most likely is not coming back from that, because most likely when the person scored their points, they did it at the perfect time that makes it very difficult for the bottom person to get those points back. So I feel like years ago, people didn't spend time in certain positions because of the fact somebody's on your back, you lost. Somebody mounted you, you probably lost. Somebody put you inside control, you probably lost. So a lot of the people just spent time training, working, especially from the competitive aspect. You're only going to be working the positions where you know that you're winning from, right? And because if you get put in these other positions, it's very hard to score 2 points back at the highest level. It's 2 points doesn't sound like a lot, but with time constraints, when the points were scored, it actually is a lot. So I think as sub only, I think is what evolved to training, is because people had to be good at, well, there's no penalty for me getting my guard passed, but I need to be able to get my guard back without getting submitted. That's where I think people took a little bit more of a mindset of positional training. And I think people also more like training positionally, I think, is important. But I still am big on you need to do live rounds. I still think like you need to get your live rounds in. I think positional training is also very helpful if you're the best person in the room. I think like positional training, because you're forcing yourself to be in bad positions with people that aren't as good as you. So it helps you work those positions. You're kind of giving them something so that you can get working. But I still think that you need to have those couple rounds with a couple people every week where it's like either you're better than them or they're just as good as you. Or maybe if you can find somebody that's better than you, if you're a serious competitor, you still need all those. And then mixed with the positional training and skill development, I think that's what I'm starting to realize might be a good recipe. It's just like everything. Why eliminate one? We should be mixing everything that works, put it together, and should be mixing it together on a daily basis or weekly basis.
Now, you touched on training with Eddie, and I'm fascinated by this. Your time with Eddie Cummins, you sort of alluded to, and it sounds like we're similar in that respect, that we weren't the most organized individuals in terms of, like you're saying, taking notes and this kind of thing and being systematic or whatever it may be. And it takes someone like me a lot of just reps, right? Just doing lots of stuff to learn it, right? And to get it. Where it seems like someone like Eddie, and this may be reading into it, just he seems like a brilliant guy. Yeah. Can you talk about Eddie? You know him, you knew him, you trained with him for so long, so closely. Can you talk about that whole experience?
Yeah, I like to bring him up a lot because I do give him so much credit for me being able to even do this, but we're totally different opposite. Like, we're complete opposite. Like, he, I remember, had like file cabinets of notes where,
wow,
you know, like these file cabinets of notes, notebooks full of technique, full of strategies, notebooks, digital notes, everything. He was, I say, the first scientist of jiu-jitsu. Whenever people ask me, I'm like, he was one of the first guys that's doing all this scientific shit. He was the first guy that I saw that was approaching it that way. Very different from, you know, when I first started jiu-jitsu, it was still a little bit more of like, there was a lot of people that just like a little thing. I remember like when I first started jiu-jitsu, there was the thing with Kid Dale with like, he doesn't drill, you shouldn't drill. There was all this stuff. And Like I said, I'm not a big driller, but being around him, like I said, it helped me see the creative process. It helped me see that a lot of the leg stuff that you see today would not be around without him and also John and a lot of the stuff that went on. But a lot of things like the stuff like the hip lock, false freak, all those positions, like those things, the early stage stuff with him and John, the John system and stuff, like a lot of stuff wouldn't be without John. And then like Eddie did a lot of like the hip lock stuff and the false freak stuff, and like a lot of things are John and Eddie. And luckily I was able to be around those people to learn those things. So many things that I saw like being figured out and created by Eddie just by training with him every day. That's a once in a lifetime person that I don't think jiu-jitsu is ever going to see again. I'll be honest with you. And, you know, and John's an amazing coach, a once in a lifetime coach that I don't think you're ever going to see again. Yeah, but being with around Eddie, is just, it's what I think everybody is trying to kind of be like that, like super like scientific with it. But he wasn't trying to be super scientific, Eddie. He just was. That's just how his personality is. You know, I talk about him like that, but he's not that. But that's just how his personality was. That's just how he approached jiu-jitsu was in that way. That's how he approached everything from what I saw in his life. Everything he explained to me, he approached it that way. So it wasn't him trying to be that way specifically to improve his jiu-jitsu. That's just the way his brain works. Certain people I've noticed in jiu-jitsu, just in general, well, their brain works a certain way, and that's just how they do it. His brain just worked in that scientific way that it's just, that's just how he did things. It wasn't like him doing it because that was what was going to improve his jiu-jitsu. It was just like, that's how he just did it. And so it was actually really interesting to see. Like I said, I got to see a lot of how to develop techniques, like the what goes behind it. It's just sitting in a room somewhere for 2 hours, figuring out all the options off an outside scoop grip. I remember one time when I was a purple belt, he took me upstairs from Enzo's. It was me and a couple other people. And we sat there for like 2 hours just figuring out what to do with an outside scoop grip. Something as simple as that. But that's to the extent that he would go with his obsession and figuring things out. Yeah, so I mean, note-taking, like making it completely scientific. That's just how he did things. So it was actually very interesting to see. And like I said, I try to pick certain aspects because I spent so much time around him of what he does. What he did, I'm thankful that I got to spend time around the people that I did so far in jiu-jitsu. Helped me, like, it put me ahead, I think, a little bit. And just gave me a lot of experience that I think you don't realize how lucky you are to have those experiences until you meet people that are, like, that wish they were able to be in those situations. People that are training in the middle of nowhere that just really want to be able to learn jiu-jitsu and get good at jiu-jitsu. But they're very limited in the information that they have. So they save up all their money for, like, months to come to years ago. They would save up their money. I'm sure they still do to, like, go to places like Texas to train with John. People save up their money because they don't have access to the information, you know, and that's also where it's like the instructionals now, it's like makes it much easier. But years ago, people save up their money for months just to be able to go to the city and train with John, or to be in the room with guys like Gary, Eddie, and Gordon. And now it's like you can get all the information online now, but I think it's always good to still go to the source.
Did you know how special the moment was when you were in it, like with Eddie in those early days?
Not really. I think as I get older, I start to realize, like, I would like to think that I was able to see something like jiu-jitsu grow from being in the mix with it, being around the people, like, lucky enough to be around some of the people that are responsible for growing the sport. Those people are responsible for growing the sport, you know, and I was able to be around those people, even if it was for a short period of time, even if I was just a guy in the room, you know, I got to be in the room. You know, as I get older now, and sometimes I miss just being the guy in the room. Definitely a special time.
You're one of these guys now that people refer back to. They're like, back in the day, he was one of those guys. He was in there with those guys, you know? He's one of these guys that brought the legacy forward. You were the boogeyman, too, for a lot of people in competition. Like, oh, Christ, he's competing at this thing. And then watching your matches, the wars you've had, just fantastic stuff.
No, thank you. I mean, it was definitely a fun time when I was really, really competing a lot. Because back then, there wasn't a lot of Instagram. Flow wasn't a thing. So you built the reputation just by being on the competition scene. You know, you see the same guys every week. You know, every tournament you go to, the same guys. Everybody kind of knew this one's tough ball, man. You know, it was fun. I don't know how anybody saw me as a boogeyman. And it was the boogeyman. I do remember there was a time period when I was younger, of course, where I was like, definitely, I guess, fed into my own hype, where I was like, I kind of sometimes felt like I was the guy that everybody was scared of.
Yeah,
but, Definitely now when I think back at it, I'm like, oh, that was silly. But, you know, but definitely when I was younger, I did sometimes. I don't even say that loud. But in the back of my mind, I'd be like, yeah, I know every single person in this tournament right now is terrified of
good for one you.
That they don't
good
for you. I'm not curious. But yeah, no, definitely not anymore.
It was interesting watching your style back then, because what I noticed with a lot of your style back then was that you tended to be more of like a counterpuncher. What is your game developed like into now? I mean, you're obviously completely a different human being, but is that an accurate assessment?
Absolutely. I would say that because of the nature of the rule set that I came up competing in, I was definitely more of like a reactive and counter type grappler. I would give a little to get a little. You know, I was very comfortable, like, being in those situations where it was under attack, but being comfortable with countering from there. You know, I would always say that that's definitely always been my style. I would say in the aspect of, like, points tournaments and with the way that the sport is going, moving away from sub-only, which I do think it eventually will circle back around, because it seems like everything in jiu-jitsu just seems to circle back around. It just, I feel like that's how it goes. As people start to gain rules and things like that, like, I think it always reverts back to what's the most fun thing to watch. Just watching two guys go out there without having any crazy rules or anything like that is always better, in my opinion. But I do think my style has always been that, and I do think that kind of works against me in a sense for more points-oriented type tournaments, because of the fact of that, like, when it comes down to it, being reactive is never a good thing. So definitely changing from being a reactive guard player, a reactive grappler, and being more proactive and still being comfortable in the fact that I'm very comfortable being in the pocket in situations and being more of like a counter grappler, but still not being the person that goes last. You know, I'm not going second, you know, in the sense of like, I'm trying to be the guy that's aggressive going first, but being comfortable being in the counter grappling type game, you know, which is where I've always done the best. You know, when people are attacking me is when I've always done the best. When people are playing a little bit more cagey and doing just enough to not look like they're not doing anything, but just enough to not be overcommitted to anything where they can get put into a counter or a situation that they could get in trouble, has always been where I struggled the most. So definitely recognizing faults in my game. And I do think it comes from I spent pretty much my whole jiu-jitsu career competing in EBI rules and sub only. So definitely I adopted that style, and it's just adjusting the style through the times.
So then I assume, you know, with the rise of ADCC and things like that, we see the importance of things like wrestling for sure, and things like the turtle, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that.
The development of those things, you know, how's that incorporated into your game? How are you teaching that?
So I definitely have been trying to learn a lot of wrestling, even if it's just from an aspect of teaching. I definitely make sure that, like, we have wrestling classes at the gym. I have been lucky enough to make friends with a lot of wrestlers, people that wrestle in college, people that wrestle in high school. And I do have a lot of wrestling training partners that I definitely think, like, the style is, it's moving towards more of a wrestling submission-based game. And I think people turtling kind of negates the fact of people playing guard. It's like people wrestle, and when they feel like they're going to get past, they go to turtle. And people are getting very good at just defending from the turtle position and then using that to wrestle up or using that to create reverse their situations. And I definitely think, like, when I was coming up, I was always told, never go to turtle. Never turn your back to anybody. And now it's, like, totally flipped, where it's like, oh, you feel danger of getting taken down? Turtle. You feel danger of getting your guard passed? Turtle. If you just don't know what to do, turtle. You know, and so the sport is just, it's, the style is changing a lot. But like anything else, you know, it's like people will start to adjust to that. You know, I think you're going to see situations where people are going to turtle, and you're going to see a little bit more of like a wrestling approach to turtle positions, where you're going to see people understanding how to break the turtle down more. So guys aren't going to be able to just stay in turtle. You're going to see a lot of matches where it's like, there's going to be a lot of stalling in turtle now from top and bottom. And that's where you see advancements. That's where you see things kind of like phase in and phase out. Like I said, it's how the sport goes. But I definitely see that because of things like ADCC rules, people are spending more time in turtle because it's like you don't get scored on if you go to turtle. So it's like, you don't even build up those points at it. So do that turtle out. You got to just know the turtle one. So it's just spending a lot of time as that being, since it's an important skill to have, just as important as a guard, I consider like a guard position. And so we do a lot of turtle rounds at the gym too. Been doing turtle and front headlock rounds. So you should be developing good defense to the turtle to not give up your back, as well as good defense to front headlock to not give up a strangle from front headlock. Incorporating that, where years ago I couldn't really incorporate that so much because you didn't want to get your back pain, you didn't want to turn your back, you wanted to maintain your guard where you could be offensive. But with the fact of there being more wrestling heavy demand, you do see the turtle is very useful. So you're definitely seeing more people turtling, and you're seeing the benefit of having a good turtle. It can make you very hard to deal with. If you have a very good turtle, you can be very hard to score on. And if the game is points and there's no advantages, then you better know how to turtle. Or at least you better know how to attack the turtle and maintain the turtle position. And I think it's very specific to the rule set. As people do it more and it becomes more difficult for people to deal with, people evolve and maybe figure out what to do to deal with it. Then you start to see involvement in those positions offensively and defensively, right? How you're staying the defensive involvement from it. And soon you'll see more of an offensive involvement from it because people are going to start to, well, I need to be able to deal with this turtle position. And you're definitely going to see a lot more wrestling. Straight jiu-jitsu people are going to be in trouble if they're not wrestling from day one. And I wish I would have wrestled more. I did wrestle a lot. When I first started, I wrestled a lot. I was in wrestling class every week when I first started. It's just when I got into more competitions, it is mostly sub only, and I stopped wrestling. And I just focused on the guard, where I wish I wouldn't have done that. I wish I would have still been developing wrestling, because my first year and a half of training was a lot of wrestling. Pretty much every day, I enjoyed wrestling more than jiu-jitsu. I didn't really enjoy jiu-jitsu when I first started training.
You seem like to have the perfect body type for wrestling.
Yeah, so like I liked wrestling, and I wasn't good at it. So I felt like I had like a natural knack for like learning wrestling. I enjoyed it. So just like with jiu-jitsu, they went hand in hand. But I definitely liked wrestling more than jiu-jitsu. And it's just like with the sub only, you know, it was like there was no benefit to working wrestling. Yeah, at that time, it was almost like a waste of your energy to spend time wrestling in a match unless you absolutely needed to be the guy on top. You know, it was just a waste of energy. And I didn't need to be the person on top. I'd rather be on bottom. So it just wasn't something that I spent a lot of time working. But I definitely think that every gym at this point in time is going to have a wrestling coach. Everybody's going to be seeking out a D1 wrestler that just fresh out of college that wants to learn jiu-jitsu. Definitely, you should just let them train for free, teach them jiu-jitsu, and have them teach wrestling, because everyone's going to need to have that aspect of wrestling in their jiu-jitsu. You need the wrestling. A sport is evolving to where it's going to be a little bit more fun to watch too, because you're going to have a lot more wrestling involved. If you get like somebody who's like, let's say like world team bound, that just decides, I'm just going to do jiu-jitsu instead, they can be one of the best grapplers in the world in jiu-jitsu, I think, because their wrestling is going to be so high level. You give them 3 years of proper jiu-jitsu instruction, they're going to be a pro, because their wrestling is so high level. But I don't think we've gotten too many super, super high level wrestlers that were that level. Because from what I've seen, like, that there's definitely levels in wrestling. We haven't gotten anybody that level of wrestling that has switched their focus from trying to make a world team or the Olympics to jiu-jitsu, because there hasn't been a reason for them to do that. And if they switch their focus, I would say it's probably to go fight MMA, where there's more money. But if we do, that person would be the best grappler in the world, in my opinion, especially under ADCC rules.
That kind of dovetails into like Michael Lira, and I've been talking to a lot of people about this one too, is just seeing the little kids coming into it now, right? I mean, we're talking like 5 years old and under even starting jiu-jitsu now, and they are sticking with it for so long. God forbid they learn some wrestling too. Your thoughts on that?
I think if you want to have a serious competition team, you need to have a kids program and like do what AOJ does, where they're bringing them up from when they're young, and then they have like Tynan and Cole and those kids, like the Rotolos were there originally, you know, like from what I understand. It's so much easier for kids with a support system to be able to train jiu-jitsu all day long and only focus on jiu-jitsu, because they're kids. They don't really have much to worry about, especially if they're training jiu-jitsu. Where like adults, life kind of gets in the way. They got to have a job. They have to focus on whatever it is. Or they have to be okay with making the sacrifice of, well, not going to have any money as an adult in order to pursue jiu-jitsu. So I definitely think it's easier to build like a good, solid, competitive team when you're starting with them as kids. and teach kids the right way, because kids also learn much faster. It's crazy how fast kids actually learn jiu-jitsu. You're going to have guys like Yara who are like world-class grapplers who are now teaching the kids class, where years ago it was just a random person teaching the kids class. You know what I'm saying? You got a world-class person like Jason Suarez teaching the kids class at Essential, and then you see those kids going to tournaments and they look really good. And then you see AOJ kids like Titan is teaching the kids class. You're going to see that a lot more because you're investing in the kids, and that's where I think you're going to have monsters when they get to the age of 18. Because they're also going to be getting the best possible instruction. They're not just going to be learning from some random person. They're getting a world-class, world-known instructor. Especially since the sport's growing now, you're going to see a lot more kids from like the age of like 3 or 4, like when they started jiu-jitsu until 18, and then competing at the highest level and winning and being a problem.
You know, that's what blurs the whole belt system for me, because it used to be like, oh, look at Cole. You know, he's this blue belt that's just crushing all these black belts. And everyone used to say, oh, well, it's just him because he's an anomaly or this and that. But as you just said, man, you know what I mean?
I think there's a bunch of kids just like that.
Yeah, tons now.
I think there's tons just like that now. I think it's going to be more common as the years go on. I think it's going to be more common. You're definitely going to be at an advantage the younger you start training as the years go on, especially with the fact that there being so much information out there, especially with the fact that there being so many world-class guys now that are taking the time to invest in teaching the kids.
It's interesting. Like, some people are saying, yeah, that gone are the days of the guy who jumped in at 20 and 30 to become a world champion. You know what I mean?
I definitely think it's going to be harder. I definitely think it's going to be harder. It's going to be tough.
John, can you tell me a time that you considered quitting and why?
Oh, yesterday. No, I'm kidding. I would say there's two major times, all right? I wouldn't say considered completely quitting the first time, but definitely not pursuing it as like a career, was when RIC EVI that I won, because I was getting older. I was 23. I wasn't getting an opportunity to compete in EVI, and I won a bunch of tournaments at the time, and it was like, well, what's the next step? I was just at a point where it's like, all right, well, what's the next step? Do I do the IBJJFs, where basically, because that was what the thing was, is the IBJJFs, and then there's ADCC and stuff. But at the time, EVI was the biggest thing. So there was a point in time where like UBI was on that same level as like winning worlds, I think, or like ADCC, just from the standpoint of that's what was popular. You know, not saying that it is, but just from the standpoint of, in my mind, that's what I saw it as. I saw it as that was the biggest thing. So that was like, well, if I'm not going to get on that, even though I've done everything that I could possibly do, what's the next step? And so I'm like getting wheeled rear, and I never wanted to be the guy who, nothing wrong with that, but I never wanted to be the guy that doesn't like have a family and isn't able to support their family, marry. And like, I always wanted to be that guy. And I wanted to take part in being able to support a family and stuff. And it just seemed like it wasn't going to go that direction. And then I just happened to get into the EVI and won. And then the time after that, when I quit, where I actually like considered like actually quitting, not just putting it on the side as like a hobby, was after that EBI. Was just like lots of frustration with like not having a team. Eddie went to Unity, and I left the city and stopped training with John and had to force out with people. And it was just like in a situation where it was like, now I really don't know where I'm going, what I'm doing. That was like the point where I actually like really, really considered like quitting. And I grew to a point where I like actually like kind of hated jiu-jitsu a little bit. Like I didn't want to do it. It was like a 3-year span where I didn't even want to compete at all. And it was like, I didn't really enjoy training, and I kind of like hated the sport a little bit. There wasn't like a lot of match opportunities coming up, and like, you think like, all right, I won this thing, and now I'm going to be able to make a living, and like, there's going to be tons of opportunities and all these things, and then there was nothing. It was like, well, I'm back here with, now I did this thing that I thought was going to change everything, and it changed absolutely nothing. It took me realizing that at the end of the day, I was going to have to change everything myself. You know, like I was going to have to go put myself out there more. If I wanted to make a living doing jiu-jitsu, I had to pursue teaching. I had to do all these things that were never in my mind. But my idea of pursuing jiu-jitsu when I decided to was competing, and that's how I made my living. But then you realize there's a lot
more than that.
It's a lot more than that. It's so difficult to just make a living competing. And at the time, social media wasn't really a thing. So you couldn't build a following to be able to have these other sources of income, whether it was instructionals or Patreon or whatever. It's either you were the big name that was in Gracie Magazine or you were nobody. So it was like I was just at a point where I was like, man, I don't even know what I'm doing myself still. Like I did this thing that I thought was going to change everything and it changed nothing. It actually like made my life 10 times worse. So it was like winning this thing made my life 10 times worse than it was. I would have been better off without it. But now it's everything's better in my life. You know, I still have moments. I feel like everybody who really cares about jiu-jitsu, you have days where you love it. And then you have days where you absolutely hate it. And then last week, I absolutely hated jiu-jitsu. This week, I love it. It's a love-hate thing. I've been doing it for so long. I feel like that's just how it is for me. It's only because you care. I feel like I've learned it's like when I hate it, it's because I care. You know, I actually genuinely care about the sport of jiu-jitsu. I genuinely care about my jiu-jitsu. I genuinely care about my students. You know, when my students lose matches, I'm not mad at them. I actually get upset with myself. I'm like, I have to figure out what I can do to make sure that they're performing better. You know, I have to make sure, see what is it that I'm missing to have them have the success that I know that they're working so hard for. Like I said, that was the time when I actually wanted to quit. And then it's just remembering all the things that why I enjoyed jiu-jitsu and that made me want to still continue doing it. And finding teaching, not just competing, is what kept me doing jiu-jitsu. Going to tournaments and cornering people and not like being like, well, they did good because of me, but being able to help them do well, to me, is just as fulfilling as winning a tournament myself. Having that joy helped me with dealing with the lack of joy that I was having in the other aspects of it. You know, that joy of teaching is what kept me wanting to be involved in jiu-jitsu, I feel like.
So, John, what makes a great student?
Honestly, I don't feel like there's like one perfect student. I've come across so many different students in different ways. I have students, they excel by taking that scientific approach, taking notes, studying a ton. And then I have students that just like show up and they're just there every day and they just try to work harder than every other person in the room. So I really don't think that there's like a perfect student. I feel like you have to figure out what works for you. You have to recognize they're figuring out what works for them and they're doing whatever it is that works for them to the best of their abilities is what I would say. Them piggybacking off whatever attributes it is that they have is what makes them a good student, I would say. Because like I said, I have experienced different students. Sometimes a lot of people are like, this is the only way to be good, but it's like everybody's different. If you feel like you're being forced to do something, it's definitely going to take you longer to be able to get good at that thing if you're being forced to do it. You have to want to do it, but you still have to work hard at whatever it is that you're doing. And you take your own approaches to it, and that's fine. I definitely think just a perfect student is somebody that is able to recognize their attributes, and then they're able to use that to help them get better. Not so much being like a clone of somebody else, but like figuring out what's going to help them excel, and then they use that to get better. That's a good student.
What do you think makes a great instructor?
He's still trying to figure that out. I think number one, when people are in the room and you're teaching the class, it's about them. It's not about you. And you have to make sure that everything is focused around trying to make them better. The one thing I do sometimes is if I'm working on something, I try to find a way to have them do the same thing. So in class, if I'm working the topic, they're going to be working that topic. That's where I'm kind of getting into work as well. But I definitely think as a good instructor, I think your focus needs to be your students for sure. And I think you need to, like, when you're in class, no matter what's going on, you need to make the environment welcoming and you need to make it where you're focused on them. I've experienced it. They're in a bad mood and they take it out on the students in the room. That's never okay. No matter what's going on in the day, I make sure that the second I walk in the room, I'm making sure that I'm focused on the students in the room. I'm acting the way that I know would make everybody in the room, whether it's their first day or they're there every day, feel comfortable. You know, I want everybody to feel comfortable because, like I said, I've experienced being in a room where it's like very anxious. Like everyone's high strung just because the person who's in charge of the room, whether they're in a bad mood or in a good mood, they kind of like project that onto the rest of the room. That can change the environment of the whole group. And everybody in the room. So I definitely think like that's what makes it, I think that's one of the many aspects, as well as being on top of studying tape and studying your students and watching their matches back and watching their roles and critiquing and rolling with your students and make sure that you see where they're at. That just all comes with being like present and there for the students, you know? And I think that what I've noticed makes a good instructor. People can tell when you're trying to be present, when you're trying to really, really help them. People get a read on that. Even if you're not saying it, hey, I'm trying my best to do this for you. If you do it the right way, I feel like people can get a sense of that. And that helps people be motivated. If they know that you want to help them get better, of course, they're going to be motivated to put the energy into the work and to get better. So I definitely think that that's important.
What I want to know about is this topic that I like to call jiu-jitsu dogma. So things that maybe we used to believe in that maybe we don't anymore in terms of, like, you know, whatever it may be. Specifically to the leg game, now that I got you, since you're such an expert in that, among other things, I know things that used to work that maybe aren't working so much. You know, every professional has different sort of viewpoints on things like this. I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on this?
So I would say the times of tapping to hook, somebody standing and tapping to that, I think are done. The times of just getting to like a massage or a saddle position on somebody and you just roll the leg without the person turning the right way is done. I think those little things, it's a very easy solution to some of those positions, is just turn the right way. And if somebody's explosive and they turn the right way fast enough, it's hard. If they do the right things and they do it fast and explosive, it's hard. So I would say that's where you see the involvement of different leg positions, where it's like you see cross-ashi with double leg control. You see reaping with double leg control. You see more people playing outside ashi again because they see playing reaps can be hard once you're sweaty and the person understands the proper way to turn. I think you're seeing less 50-50, again, because of the fact that people are becoming more skilled. They're not just trying to turn out of 50-50. They understand the position a little bit more. You know, I definitely think you're going to see more positions that you're able to maintain control for longer periods of time. Just like a cross-ashi saddle position where you're just controlling the leg you're attacking, that's done. Looking to throw on like a sambo loop from an ashi position, a single leg X, probably not going to happen. Not going to be effective unless you like are holding an ankle lock grip and you're using it to transition a second leg control. That's going to be hard as well. I think you are going to start to see more different variations of ankle lock finishes because of the level of control you have with an ankle lock, like the Shishinsky type ankle locks, you know.
Isn't it weird how these like old school things have developed?
These are just old school moves that are just like, all right, well, we threw this out because we thought the heel hook was stronger. Yes, it's a stronger blink. But at the same time, here we are because of the level of control of something as simple as different variations or grips on ankle locks. Because what we're lacking is control and we need more control for it. You know, what if things like that change?
How about any like big sort of traditional positions like reverse De La Hiva?
I definitely think it's not a position anymore that you want to be staying. I definitely don't think it's a position you want to be staying in as much anymore. I definitely think it's a position that it's like you end up there, it's solely because you were forced there. And you need to be doing what you need to do to create off balance. And I would say like a position like reverse De La Hiva, your best weapon is a nice big inversion. And you need to be not staying in reverse De La Hiva for long periods of time. You need to be either inverting or you're throwing false reaps and things of that nature immediately. Or you need to be getting back to a position where you're playing more of a De La Hiva guard or a K guard where you're a little bit more offensive. It's too much of a reactive defensive guard, I think. And I years ago didn't believe it, but I definitely believe it a little bit more now.
Your expectations of different belt colors?
So I would say for like white to blue, I usually look for that somebody is starting to develop a game. So when I consider somebody to be a blue belt is that they're starting to develop a game. Where it's like, maybe that game isn't like where they can go in and submit a black belt, but at least I can watch them rolling. They're doing jiu-jitsu and I can get a read on when I'm watching them that they're developing a game of whether it's they're playing a game of De La Hiva guards to attack the back, where they're playing a seated butterfly guard where they're looking for wrestle-ups to get on top and then pass, or they're using more of a wrestling-based game to get on top and get into a good passing game. Like, that's like what I look for, is that they, of course, understand like how to escape side control, how to escape the mount, though most of the basic fundamental things like hip escaping and Kimuras, guillotines, and they know the basic terminology and stuff. But the big thing that I look for is that as a blue belt, you should be able to walk into a room, roll with people, and be like, well, this is my game that I play, and this is what I'm looking for. So I think in order to be a blue belt, that's one of the things that I look for, and that you have like one or two submissions that maybe if you throw it on one of the higher belts in the room, you might catch them because you're really good at those one or two submissions. I feel like you need to have a game, and you need to have that game that gets you to a position where you're looking to finish. And then you have like a submission where it's like, well, that's your game is funneling you into that submission. And if you get there, you should be winning. That's kind of like how I judge from white to blue. When I perfect, you know, you're able to expand that game. I see that you're learning new stuff, you're expanding your game, you're getting better at implementing your game and adding new tools to your game, and not just waiting for me to like teach you new tools to your game. You know, I see that you're experimenting, you're learning how to teach yourself, because I do consider like a puckle belt, like the belt where it's like, you should be able to sit somebody down and explain techniques to them as a purple belt. So I definitely look for like, you have your game and you're adding new things to your game and expanding on your game. You're teaching yourself how to do that. You know, that's one of the things that I look for there. And then from purple to brown, it's just pure, you know, a competitive good purple belt should be able to compete with a black belt, in my opinion. Like as a blue belt and a white belt, you're expected to kind of like almost lose the rounds, you know, to certain people. And as a purple belt, if I'm watching you and from purple to brown and you're hanging in there with the brown and the black belts and going the back and forth, and if you're a competitor, you're doing well at purple, then it's like, it's time for a brown belt. And then eventually I just kind of like look at it like, you know, you're just ready to take on being a black belt. If you want to teach, I know that you're ready to be able to have students. If you want to be a black belt competitor, I know that you're ready to be able to handle the black belt competition. You know, if you want to be a serious competitor or even an obvious competitor. Basic stuff that I look for. But main things is in the technique wise, I think is those lower belt, while white to purple, is when I really, really, really look at technically what it is that you're doing. And then from purple to black is how you're implementing it against other higher level people in the world or higher levels in the world.
What comes to mind when you think of an aha moment?
Oh, wow. Oh, I would definitely say realizing how much easier it is to enter on people's legs from top position than it is from bottom. It's much easier to get good control on somebody's leg, to attack their leg when you're on top of them, than it is when you're underneath them. When you're underneath them, they always have that ability to kind of run away, you know, but when you're on top of them, you're eliminating that ability for them to run away. The most they can do is then give you their back to avoid getting like blocked or give up a guard pass. So attacking somebody's legs from top actually opens up all the other stuff that you're looking to do. Having that threat of always like attacking somebody's legs makes you guard passing easier, because people are going to either give up their guard to protect their legs, or they're going to give up their back to protect their legs. So definitely that's an aha moment. My game is so much better when I'm able to be on top of somebody than underneath a personal. The hard part is getting on top of somebody that doesn't want to end up on bottom.
What are people that they underestimate you or often don't bring up about your game?
I think everybody that tends to me would say I have a fairly good back game and front headlock game. I would say that's my second best aspect of my game, aside from my guard and my leg attack. I would say most of my training, I am attacking front headlocks, the back, and leg attacks. And they all train very well together from bottom or top. A lot of people that train me, if they had to say like one other thing that I do very well is attack the back or take the back. I don't do much in competition, but at least in competition, the recent thing that I've done, you have seen me, or I've gotten guillotine finishes and finishes from the back, because that's two things that I've really focused on in the past 2 years, has just been developing a good front headlock game and a good back attack game, and just being able to finish from the back more. So those are two positions that I really, really honed in and focused a lot of attention on. And I would say those are two things that I think people don't see much from me, but when you do see it or feel it, I think people recognize that, oh, he's pretty good at those things too. Sometimes I feel like I'm better at attacking the back than I am at leg attack. Or sometimes I just would rather be on somebody's back than attacking their legs. But it's going to be a hard thing to do in competition without enough practice under competitive stress doing it. which is another thing why I tell people to feed all the time as much as you can as a lower belt, because when nobody's watching, it's the best time to get experience.
I want to talk about your media because it's so great. You got Daijutsu Lord of the Guards has been out for a while. You got your Patreon. Your Instagram is really slick now. It looks like you really invested some time and effort into this.
In the past year, I was committed to building my Instagram in order to put more content out there, to be able to just teach more people, and putting in some instructional content out. Like, we have the Lord of the Guards instructional out on Daijutsu, and Daijutsu's making a comeback. That was one of the big companies when I was first starting out, and they kind of like went away for a while. It was Beat Our Videos and Daijutsu, and so now they're coming back. So now we're putting out some content. We just did the Lord of the Guards, and then there's actually another instructional on the way, and it was a few more planned. There's another one that's filmed that would be probably, I'm gonna say, look out for in April. It's gonna be on the Daijutsu website. Also, we filmed one of my seminars recently that's on there too. So one of my seminars is on there, the guard retention instructional is on there, and there's gonna be another instructional on there soon in April. And then we'll throw in a few more. So just put content out there. And then have my Patreon, which has my weekly classes for my kings on there. There's some one-off technique videos. There's live rolling footage on there. There's things that I'm trying to put out there now. My Instagram. And then all the links are right there in the bio for everything.
I'm glad that you are getting yourself out there more, because that's one of the things I felt like I haven't seen enough of you for a while there, you know.
Yeah.
And then you've put this effort in. You mentioned like a year ago into this Instagram thing, and then all of a sudden you're back, and I'm like, man, this is a hidden treasure.
No, thank you.
You have so much to offer to the community, and I think it's a disservice if that doesn't happen. So no. I'm glad to see all this stuff coming forward, you know.
No, thank
you. And I know how it is. A lot of you guys don't like to promote yourselves, you know. A lot of you guys that have been in this game for a while too,
yeah,
are just not comfortable with the whole thing. But it's so good,
yeah,
that you guys are coming forward now. It's
no,
a big deal.
No, yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's definitely something I wasn't like really into for a while, but it's like something you have to do, you know, something you have to do in this sport. It's part of the game at this point, you know, it's part of it.
Well, John, you know, I know you covered most of it, but if we want to, the listener, the viewer out there wants to get more information about you and everything that you're up to, where can they go?
Follow my Instagram. There's lots of content coming out on my Patreon. Switch it up a little bit. I'm going to be doing weekly Q&A. So you just, as a subscriber, you write what it is that you want us, any questions you have. And then I'm basically going to make videos answering every single one of those questions. And every Monday, I've just been posting those videos answering questions that any of my subscribers have. So it's a little bit more interactive. Weekly classes that I put up there, some rolling footage that I put up there. And then I have Daijutsu instructionals that are up already, two of them up already, and there's another one on the way. And just going to keep putting out more content on my Instagram, maybe in the future start a YouTube channel. You know, I want to be able to teach more people that want to be able to learn from me. So, you know, just putting out as much as I can.
And go check out John at Kings, right?
Yeah, Kings, and also at Henslow Brooklyn if you guys want to come by there. But Kings, I'm there every night, and Henslow's on there every day.
Great.
Yeah.
And you guys, it's John_Calistine, right?
Yep.
On IG.
Yep.
And we'll put all the links to everything John mentioned in the show notes. So I am your host, Adolfo Fronda. Thanks, you guys, for watching. Give us the whole thumbs up. Think about joining our VIP membership. It's only $1 a month. Come on. So thanks, everyone, for watching. We'll see you guys next time. John, man, this was a tremendous honor. Super fun. And, man, I'm so happy to connect.
No, thank you. It was great. No, thank you for sure. 100%.
Take care. See you next time.